Now she could see the dried red matter and the yellow nub of bone where it had been hacked off the human neck. She blinked and looked up at the other two mannequins. One of them had the head of a teenage boy, his mouth slack and tongue lolling, both eyeballs turned to the ceiling and a crust of blood at the nostrils. The third one's head was that of an elderly man, his face heavily lined and the color of chalk. Swan stepped back across the aisle and hit a fourth and fifth mannequin dressed in women's clothes. The severed heads of a middle-aged woman and a little girl with red hair fell out of the collars and thumped to the floor on either side of her. The little girl's face was directed up at Swan, the awful blood-drained mouth open in a soundless cry of terror. Swan screamed. Screamed long and loud and couldn't stop screaming. She backpedaled away from the human heads, still screaming, and as she spun around, she saw another mannequin nearby, and another, and another. Some of the heads beaten and battered, and the others painted and prettied with makeup to give them false and obscene smiles. She thought that if she couldn't stop screaming, her lungs would burst, and as she ran for Josh and Leona, the scream died because all her air was gone. She pulled in breath and raced away from the grisly heads, and over Josh's shouts, she heard the terrier give a yipe, yipe, yipe of pain from the rear of the Kmart. "Swan!" Josh yelled, spitting out half-chewed candy. He saw her coming toward him, her face as yellow as the Kansas dust and tears streaming down her cheeks. "What is Blue Light Special?" A merry voice sang over the Kmart's intercom system. "Attention, shoppers! Blue Light Special! 3 new arrivals at the front! Hurry for the best bargains!" They heard the rough roar of a motorcycle's engine firing. Josh scooped Swan up as a motorcycle hurtled at them along the center aisle, its driver dressed like a traffic cop except for his Indian headdress. "Look out!" Leona shouted, and Josh leaped across a counter full of ice cube trays with Swan in his arms, the motorcycle skidding past them into a display of transistor radios. More figures were running toward them along the other aisles, and there was an ungodly whooping and hollering that drowned out the Blue Light Special being repeated over the intercom. Here came a mountainous, black-bearded man pushing a gnarled dwarf in a shopping cart, followed by other men of all ages and descriptions, wearing all kinds of clothing from suits to bathrobes, some of them with streaks of war paint on their faces, others daubed white with powder. Josh realized, sickeningly, that most of them were carrying weapons, axes, picks, hoes, garden shears, pistols and rifles, knives and chains. The aisles were a crawl with them, and they jumped over the counters grinning and yelling. Josh, Swan, and Leona were driven together and ringed by a shouting mob of 40 or more men. "Protect the child," Josh thought. And as one of the men darted in to grab Swan's arm, Josh delivered a kick to his ribs that snapped bones and sent him flying back into the rabble. The move brought more gleeful cheers. The gnarled dwarf in the shopping cart, whose wrinkled face was decorated with orange lightning bolts, crowed, "Fresh meat! Fresh meat!" The others took up the shout. An emaciated man plucked at Leona's hair, and someone else grabbed her arm to pull her into the crowd. She became a wildcat, kicking and biting, driving her tormentors back. A heavy body landed on Josh's shoulders, raking at his eyes, but he twisted and flung the man off into the sea of leering faces. Swan struck out with crybaby, hit one of those ugly faces in the nose, and saw it pop open. "Fresh meat!" the dwarf yelled. "Come get your fresh meat!" The black-bearded man began to clap his hands and dance. Josh hit someone square in the mouth and two teeth flew like dice in a crap game. "Get away," he roared. "Get away from us." But they were closing in now, and there were just too many. Three men were pulling Leona into the throng, and Josh caught a glimpse of her terrified face. A fist rose and fell, and Leona's legs buckled. "Damn it!" Josh raged, kicking the nearest maniac in the kneecap. "Protect the child. I've got to protect the..." A fist struck him in the kidneys. His legs were kicked out from under him, and he lost his grip on Swan as he fell. Fingers gouged at his eyes. A fist crashed into his jaw. Shoes and boots pummeled his sides and back, and the whole world seemed to be in violent motion. "Swan!" he shouted, trying to get up. Men clung to him like rats. He looked up through a red haze of pain and saw a man with bulging fish-like eyes standing over him, lifting an axe. He flung his arms up in an ineffectual gesture to ward it off, but he knew the axe was about to fall, and that would be the end of it. "Ah, damn," he thought as blood trickled from his mouth. "What a way to go." He braced for the blow, hoping that he could stand up with his last strength and knock the bastard's brains out. The axe reached its zenith, poised to fall, and a booming voice shouted over the tumult, "Cease!" The effect was like a bullwhip being cracked over the heads of wild animals. Almost to a man, they flinched and drew back. The fish-eyed man lowered the axe, and the others released Josh. He sat up, saw Swan a few feet away, and drew her to him. She was still holding on to Crybaby, her eyes swimming with shock. Leona was on her knees nearby, blood oozing from a cut above her left eye and a purple swelling coming up on her cheekbone. The mob backed away, open to make passage for someone. A heavy-set, fleshy, bald-headed man in overalls and cowboy boots, his chest bare and his muscular arms decorated with weird multicolored designs, walked into the circle. He was carrying an electric bullhorn, and he looked down at Josh with dark eyes beneath a protruding Neanderthal brow. "Oh, shit," Josh thought. The guy was at least as big as some of the heavyweight wrestlers he'd grappled. But then behind the bald-headed Neanderthal came two other men with painted faces, supporting a toilet between them, hoisted up on their shoulders. And on that toilet sat a man draped in a deep purple robe, his hair a blonde shoulder-length mane of loose curls. He had a downy beard of fine blonde hair covering a gaunt, narrow face, and under thick blonde brows his eyes were murky olive-green. The color reminded Josh of the water of a swimming hole near his childhood home where two young boys had drowned on a summer morning. It was said, he recalled, that monsters lay coiled in wait at the bottom of that cloudy green water. The young man, who might have been anywhere from 20 to 25, wore white gloves, blue jeans, Adidas sneakers, and a red plaid shirt. On his forehead was a green dollar sign. On his left cheekbone was a red crucifix, and on his right was a black devil's pitchfork. The Neanderthal lifted the bullhorn to his mouth and roared, "All shall praise Lord Alvin." Chapter 40. Macklin had heard the siren song of screaming in the night, and now he knew it was time. He eased out of his sleeping bag, careful not to jostle Roland or Sheila. He didn't want either of them to go with him. He was afraid of the pain, and he didn't want them to see him weak. Macklin walked out of the tent into the cold, sweeping wind. He began to head in the direction of the lake. Torches and campfires flickered all around him, and the wind tugged at the greenish-black bandages that trailed off the stump of Macklin's right wrist. He could smell the sickly odor of his own infection, and for days the wound had been oozing gray fluid. He put his left palm over the handle of the knife in the waistband of his trousers. He was going to have to open the wound again and expose the flesh to the healing agony of the Great Salt Lake. Behind him, Roland Croninger had sat up as soon as Macklin left the tent. The .45 was gripped in his hand. He always slept with it, even kept hold of it when Sheila Fontana let him do the dirty thing to her. He liked to watch, also, when Sheila took the king on. In turn, They fed Sheila and protected her from the other men. They were becoming a very close trio, and now he knew where the king was going and why. The king's wound had been smelling very bad lately. Soon there would be another scream in the night, like the others they heard when the encampment got quiet. He was a king's knight, and he thought he should be at the king's side to help him, but this was something the king wanted to do alone. Roland lay back down, the pistol resting on his chest. Sheila muttered something and flinched in her sleep. Roland listened for the cry of the king's rebirth. Macklin passed other tents, cardboard box shelters, and cars that housed whole families. The smell of the salt lake stung his nostrils, promised a pain and a cleansing beyond anything Macklin had ever experienced. The land began to slope slightly downward toward the water's edge, and lying on the ground around him were blood-caked clothes, rags, crutches, and bandages torn off and discarded by other supplicants before him. He remembered the screams he'd heard in the night, and his nerve faltered. He stopped less than 20 feet from where the lake rippled up over the rocky shore. His phantom hand was itching, and the stump throbbed painfully with his heartbeat. "I can't take it," he thought. "Ah, dear God, I can't."
"Discipline and control, mister,"
a voice said off to his right. The shadow soldier was standing there, white bony hands on hips, the moon-like face streaked with commando grease paint under the helmet's rim.
"You lose those, and what have you got?"
Macklin didn't answer. The lapping of the water on the shore was both seductive and terrifying.
"Your nerve going bye-bye, Jimmy boy?"
the shadow soldier asked, and Macklin thought that the voice was similar to his father's. It carried the same note of taunting disgust.
"Well, I'm not surprised,"
the shadow soldier continued.
"You sure pulled a royal fuck up at Earth House, didn't you? Oh, you really did a fine job."
"No," Macklin shook his head.
"It wasn't my fault."
The shadow soldier laughed quietly.
"You knew, Jimmy boy. You knew something was wrong in Earth House, and you kept packing the suckers in because you smelled the green of the Osley cash, didn't you? Man, you killed all those poor chumps. You buried them under a few hundred tons of rock and saved your own ass, didn't you?"
Now Macklin thought it really was his father's voice. And he thought that the shadow soldier's face was beginning to resemble the fleshy, hawk-nosed face of his long-dead father as well.
"I had to save myself," Macklin replied, his voice weak. "What was I supposed to do? Lie down and die?" "Shit. That kid's got more sense and guts than you do, Jimmy boy. He's the one who got you out. He kept you moving, and he found food to keep your ass alive. If it wasn't for that kid, you wouldn't be standing here right now, shaking in your shoes because you're afraid of a little pain. That kid knows the meaning of discipline and control, Jimmy boy. You're just a tired old cripple who ought to go out in that lake, duck your head under, and take a quick snort like they did."
The shadow soldier nodded toward the lake where the bloated bodies of suicides floated in the brine.
"You used to think being head honcho at Earth House was the bottom of the barrel. But this is the bottom, Jimmy boy, right here. You're not worth a shit, and you've lost your nerve."
"No, I haven't," Macklin said. "I haven't." A hand gestured toward the Great Salt Lake.
"Prove it."
Roland sensed someone outside the tent. He sat up, clicking the safety off the automatic. Sometimes the men came around at night, sniffing for Sheila, and they had to be scared off. A flashlight shone in his face, and he aimed the pistol at the figure who held it.
"Hold it," the man said. "I don't want any trouble."
Sheila cried out and sat bolt upright, her eyes wild. She drew herself away from the man with a light.
She'd been having that nightmare again, of Rudy shambling to the tent, his face bleached of blood and the wound at his throat gaping like a hideous mouth, and from between his purple lips came a rattling voice that asked, "Killed any babies lately, Sheila, darling?"
"You'll get trouble if you don't back off."
Roland's eyes were fierce behind the goggles. He held the pistol steady, his finger poised on the trigger.
"It's me, Judd Lowry."
He shone the flashlight on his own face. "See?
What do you want?"
Lowry pointed the light at Macklin's empty sleeping bag.
"Where'd the colonel go?"
"Out."
"What do you want?"
"Mr. Kempka wants to talk to you."
"What about?"
"I delivered the ration last night."
"He wants to talk," Lowry said. "He says he's got a deal for you."
"A deal? What kind of deal?"
"A business proposal."
"I don't know the details. You'll have to see him."
"I don't have to do anything," Roland told him.
"And whatever it is can wait until daylight."
"Mr. Kempka," Lowry said firmly, "wants to do business right now. It's not important that Macklin be here. Mr. Kempka wants to deal with you. He thinks you've got a good head on your shoulders, so are you coming or not?"
"Not."
Lowry shrugged.
"Okay, then. I guess I'll tell him you're not interested."
He started to back out of the tent, then stopped.
"Oh, yeah, he wanted me to give you this."
And he dropped a box full of Hershey bars on the ground in front of Roland.
"He's got plenty of stuff like that over in the trailer."
"Jesus!"
Sheila's hand darted into the box and plucked out some of the chocolate bars.
"Man, it's been a long time since I've had one of these."
"I'll tell him what you said,"
Lowry told Roland. And again, he started to leave the tent.
"Wait a minute,"
Roland blurted out.
"What kind of deal does he want to talk about?"
"Like I say, you'll have to see him to find out."
Roland hesitated, but he figured whatever it was couldn't hurt.
"I don't go anywhere without the gun," he said.
"Sure, why not?"
Roland got out of his sleeping bag and stood up. Sheila, already finishing one of the chocolate bars, said,
"Hey, hold on, what about me?"
"Mr. Kempka just wants the boy."
"Kiss my ass. I'm not staying out here alone."
Lowry shrugged the strap of his shotgun off his shoulder and handed it to her.
"Here, and don't blow your head off by accident."
She took it, realizing too late that it was the same weapon he'd used to kill the infant. Still, she wouldn't dare be left out there alone without a gun. Then she turned her attention to the box of Hershey bars, and Roland followed Judd Lowry to the Airstream trailer, where yellow lantern light crept through the slats of the drawn window blinds. On the edge of the lake, Macklin took off his black overcoat and the filthy blood-stained T-shirt he wore. Then he began to unwrap the bandages from the stump of his wrist as the shadow soldier watched in silence. When he was done, he let the bandages fall. The wound was not pretty to look at, and the shadow soldier whistled at the sight.
"Discipline and control, mister," the shadow soldier said. "That's what makes a man."
Those were the exact words of Macklin's father. He'd grown up hearing them pounded into his head, had fashioned them into a motto to live by. Now, though, to make himself walk into the salty water and do what had to be done was going to take every ounce of discipline and control he could summon. The shadow soldier said in a sing-song voice,
"Hup, 2, 3, 4, hup, 2, 3, 4, get it in gear, mister."
"Oh, Jesus," Macklin breathed. He stood with his eyes tightly shut for a few seconds, his entire body shook with the cold wind and his own dread. Then he took the knife from his waistband and walked down toward the chuckling water.
"Sit down, Roland,"
the fat man said as Lowry escorted Roland into the trailer. A chair had been pulled up in front of the table that Kempka sat behind.
Shut the door.
Lawrie obeyed him, and Roland sat down. He kept his hand on the pistol, and the pistol in his lap. Kempka's face folded into a smile.
Would you like something to drink? Pepsi, Coke, 7-Up? How about something stronger?
He laughed in his high, shrill voice, and his many chins wobbled.
You are of legal age, aren't you?
I'll take a Pepsi.
Ah, good. Judd, would you get us 2 Pepsis, please?
Lawrie got up and went to another room, which Roland figured must be a kitchen.
What'd you want to see me about? Roland asked.
A business deal, a proposition.
Kempka leaned back and his chair popped and creaked like fireworks going off. He wore an open-collared sports shirt that showed wiry brown hair on his flabby chest, and his belly flopped over the belt line of his lime-green polyester trousers. Kempka's hair had been freshly pomaded and combed, and the interior of the trailer smelled like cheap, sweet cologne.
You strike me as a very intelligent young boy, Roland. A young man, I should say, he grinned. I could tell right off that you had intelligence and fire, too. Oh, yes, I like young men with fire.
He glanced at the pistol Roland held.
You can put that aside, you know. I want to be your friend.
That's nice. Roland kept the pistol aimed in Freddy Kempka's direction. On the wall behind the fat man, the many rifles and handguns on their hooks caught the baleful yellow lamplight.
Well, Kempka shrugged. We can talk anyway. Tell me about yourself. Where are you from? What happened to your parents?
My parents, Roland thought. What had happened to them? He remembered them all going into Earth House together, remembered the earthquake in the cafeteria. But everything else was still crazy and disjointed. He couldn't even recall exactly what his mother and father had looked like. They had died in the cafeteria, he thought, yes. Both of them had been buried under rock. He was a king's knight now, and there was no turning back. That's not important, he decided to say. Is that what you wanted to talk about?
No, it's not. I wanted to... Ah, here are our refreshments.
Lawrie came in with Pepsis and 2 plastic glasses. He set one glass in front of Kempka and handed Roland the other. Lawrie started to walk behind Roland, but the boy said sharply, "Stay in front of me while I'm in here." And Lawrie stopped. The man smiled, lifted his hands in a gesture of peace, and sat on a pile of boxes against the wall.
As I say, I like young men with fire.
Kempka sipped at his drink. It had been a long time since Roland had tasted a soft drink, and he chugged almost half the glass full down without stopping. The drink had lost most of its fizz, but it was still about the best stuff he'd ever tasted.
So, what is it? Roland asked. Something about the drugs?
No, nothing about that.
He smiled again, a fleeting smile.
I want to know about Colonel Macklin.
He leaned forward and the chair squalled. He rested his forearms on the table and laced his thick fingers together.
I want to know what Macklin offers you that I can't.
What?
Look around, Kempka said. Look what I've got here. Food, drink, candy, guns, bullets, and power, Roland. What does Macklin have? A wretched little tent. And do you know what? That's all he'll ever have. I run this community, Roland. I guess you could say I'm the law, the mayor, the judge, and the jury all rolled up into one, right?
He glanced quickly at Lawrie, and the other man said, Right, with the conviction of a ventriloquist dummy.
So, what does Macklin do for you, Roland?
Kempka lifted his eyebrows.
Or should I ask what you do for him?
Roland almost told the fat man that Macklin was the king. shorn of his crown and kingdom now, but destined to return to power some day, and that he had pledged himself as a king's knight. But he figured Kempka was about as smart as a bug and wouldn't understand the grand purpose of the game, so Roland said,
"We travel together. And where are you going? To the same garbage dump Macklin is headed toward? No, I think you're smarter than that."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean that I have a large and comfortable trailer, Roland. I have a real bed."
He nodded toward a closed door.
"It's right through there. Would you like to see it?"
It suddenly dawned on Roland what Freddy Kempka had been getting at.
"No," he said, his gut tightening. "I wouldn't."
"Your friend can't offer you what I can, Roland," Kempka said in a silken voice. "He has no power. I have it all. Do you think I let you in here just because of the drugs? No. I want you, Roland. I want you here with me."
Roland shook his head. Dead motes seemed to spin before his eyes, and his head felt heavy, as if he couldn't balance it any longer on his neck.
"You're going to find that power rules this world."
Kempka's voice sounded to Roland like a record played too fast.
"It's the only thing that's worth a damn anymore. Not beauty, not love, nothing but power. And the man who has it can take anything he wants."
"Not me," Roland said.
The words felt like marbles rolling off his tongue. He thought he was about to puke, and there was a needles and pins sensation in his legs. The lamplight was hurting his eyes, and when he blinked, it took an effort to lift his lids again. He looked down into the plastic glass he held, and he could see grainy things floating at the bottom. He tried to stand up, but his legs gave way, and he fell to his knees on the floor. Someone was bending over him, and he felt the .45 being taken from his nerveless fingers. Too late. He tried to grasp it back, but Lowry was grinning and stepping out of reach.
"I found a use for some of those drugs you brought me."
Now Kempka's voice was slow and murky, an underwater slur.
"I mashed up a few of those pills and made a nice little mixture. I hope you enjoy your trip."
And the fat man began to rise ponderously from his chair and stalk across the room toward Roland Croninger, while Lowry went outside to smoke a cigarette. Roland shivered, though sweat was bursting out on his face, and scurried away from the man on his hands and knees. His brain was doing flip-flops. Everything was lurching, speeding up, and then slowing to a crawl. The whole trailer wobbled as Kempka went to the door and threw the latches. Roland squeezed himself into a corner like a trapped animal, and when he tried to shout for the king to help him, his voice almost blew his eardrums out.
"Now," Kempka said, "we'll get to know each other better, won't we?"
Macklin stood in cold water up to the middle of his thighs, the wind whipping into his face and wailing off beyond the encampment. His groin crawled, and his hand gripped the knife so hard his knuckles had gone bone white. He looked at the infected wound, saw the dark swelling that he needed to probe with the knife's gleaming tip. "Oh, God," he thought. "Dear God, help me."
"Discipline and control."
The shadow soldier was standing behind him. "That's what makes a man, Jimmy boy."
"My father's voice," Macklin thought. "God bless dear old Dad, and I hope the worms have riddled his bones."
"Do it,"
the shadow soldier commanded. Macklin lifted the knife, took aim, drew in a breath of frigid air, and brought the point of the blade down, down, down into the festered swelling. The pain was so fierce, so white-hot, so all-consuming, that it was almost pleasure. Macklin threw back his head and screamed, and as he screamed, he dug the blade deeper into the infection, deeper still, and the tears were running down his face, and he was on fire between pain and pleasure. He felt his right arm becoming lighter as the infection drained out of it, and as his scream went up into the night where the other screams had gone before his, Macklin threw himself forward into the salt water and immersed the wound. "Ah!" The fat man stopped a few feet from Roland and cocked his head toward the door. Kempka's face was flushed, his eyes shining. The scream was just drifting away. "Listen to that music," he said. "That's the sound of somebody being reborn." He began to unbuckle his belt and draw it through the many loops of his huge waistband. The images tumbling through Roland's brain were a mixture of fun house and haunted house. In his mind, he was hacking at the wrist of the king's right arm, and as the blade severed the hand, a spray of blood-red flowers shot from the wound. A chorus line of mangled corpses in top hats and tuxedos kicked their way down the wrecked corridor of Earth House. He and the king were walking on a superhighway under a sullen scarlet sky, and the trees were made of bones and the lakes were steaming blood, and half-rotted remnants of human beings sped past in battered cars and tractor-trailer trucks. He was standing on a mountaintop as the gray clouds boiled above him. Below, armies fought with knives, rocks, and broken bottles. A cold hand touched his shoulder, and a voice whispered, "It can be all yours, Sir Roland." He was afraid to turn his head and look at the thing that stood behind him, but he knew he must. The power of hideous hallucination forced his head around, and he stared into a pair of eyes that wore army surplus goggles. The flesh of that face was mottled with brown leprous growths, the lips all but eaten away to reveal misshapen fanged teeth. The nose was flat, the nostrils wide and ravaged. The face was his own, but distorted, ugly, reeking evil and bloodlust. And from that face his own voice whispered, "It can all be yours, Sir Roland, and mine too." Towering over the boy, Freddy Kempka tossed his belt to the floor and began to shimmy out of his polyester trousers. His breathing sounded like the rumbling of a furnace. Roland blinked, squinted up at the fat man. The hallucinatory visions were tumbling madly away, but he could still hear the thing's whisper. He was shaking, couldn't stop. Another vision whirled up from his mind, and he was on the ground, trembling, as Mike Armbruster towered over him, about to beat him to a bloody pulp as the other high school kids and football jocks shouted and jeered. He saw Mike Armbruster's crooked grin, and Roland felt a surge of maniacal hatred, more powerful than anything he'd ever known. Mike Armbruster had already beaten him once, had already kicked him and spat on him as he was sobbing in the dust, and now he wanted to do it all over again. But Roland knew he was far different, far stronger, far more cunning than the little pansy-assed wimp who'd let himself be beaten until he'd peed in his pants. He was a king's knight now, and he'd seen the underside of hell. He was about to show Mike Armbruster how a king's knight gets even. Kempka had one leg out of his pants. He was wearing red silk boxer shorts. The boy was staring up at him, eyes slitted behind those damned goggles, and now the boy began to make a deep, animalish sound down in his throat, a cross between a growl and an unearthly moan. "Stop that," Kempka told him. That noise gave him the creeps. The boy didn't stop, and the awful sound was getting louder. "Stop it, you little bastard!" He saw the boy's face changing, tightening into a mask of utter, brutal hatred, and the sight of it scared the shit out of Freddy Kempka. He realized that the mind-altering drugs were doing something to Roland Croninger that he hadn't counted on. "Stop it!" he shouted, and he lifted his hand to slap Roland across the face. Roland leaped forward, and like a battering ram, his head plowed into Kempka's bulging stomach. The fat man cried out and fell backward, his arms windmilling. The trailer rocked back and forth, and before Kempka could recover, Roland plowed into him again with a force that sent Kempka crashing to the floor. Then the boy was all over him, punching and kicking and biting. Kempka shouted, "Larry, help me!" But even as he said it, he remembered that he had double-bolted the door to keep the boy from escaping. Two fingers jabbed into his left eye and almost ripped it from the socket. A fist crunched into his nose, and Roland's head came forward in a vicious butting blow that hit Kempka full in the mouth, split his lips, and knocked two of his front teeth into his throat.
"Help me!"
he shrieked, his mouth full of blood. He hit Roland with a flailing forearm and swiped him off, then flopped over on his stomach and began to crawl toward that locked door.
"Help me, Larry!"
he yelled through his cracked lips. Something went around Kempka's throat and tightened, catching the blood in the fat man's head and reddening his face like an overripe tomato. He realized, panic-stricken, that the lunatic boy was strangling him with his own belt. Roland rode on Kempka's back like Ahab on the white whale. Kempka gagged, fighting to pry the belt loose. The blood pulsed in his head with a force that he feared would blow his eyeballs out. There was a hammering at the door, and Lowry's voice shouted, "Mr. Kempka, what is it?" The fat man reared up, twisted his shuddering body, and slammed Roland against the wall, but still the boy held on. Kempka's lungs strained for air, and again he threw his body to the side. This time he heard the boy's cry of pain, and the belt loosened. Kempka squalled like a hurt pig, scrabbling wildly toward the door. He reached up to release one of the latches, and a chair smashed him across the back, splintering and shooting agony up his spine. Then the boy was beating at him with a chair leg, hitting him in the head and face, and Kempka screamed,
"He's gone crazy! He's gone crazy!"
Larry pounded at the door, "Let me in!" Kempka took a dazing blow to the forehead, felt blood running down his face, and he struck out blindly at Roland. His left fist connected, and he heard the breath whoosh out of the boy. Roland collapsed to his knees. Kempka wiped blood out of his eyes, reached up, and tried to slide the first bolt back. There was blood on his fingers, and he couldn't get a good grip. Lowry was pounding on the door, trying to force it open.
"He's crazy!" Kempka wailed. "He's trying to kill me!"
"Hey, you dumb fuck!" the boy snarled behind him. Kempka looked back and whined with terror. Roland had picked up one of the kerosene lamps that illuminated the trailer. He was grinning madly, his goggles streaked with blood.
"Here you go, Mike," he yelled, and he flung the lamp.
It hit the fat man's skull and shattered, dousing his face and chest with kerosene that rippled into flame, setting his beard, hair, and the front of his sport shirt on fire.
"Burning me! Burning me!"
Kempka squalled, rolling and thrashing. The door shuddered as Lowry kicked it, but the Airstream trailer people had built it to be strong. As Kempka jitterbugged horizontally and Lowry kicked at the door, Roland turned his attention to the rack of rifles and the handguns on their hooks. He hadn't finished showing Mike Armbruster how a king's knight gets even. Oh, no. Not yet. He walked around the table and chose a beautiful .38 special with a mother-of-pearl handle. He opened the cylinder and found three bullets inside. He smiled. On the floor, the fat man had beaten the fire out. His face was a mass of scorched flesh, burned hair and blisters, his eyes so swollen he could hardly see. But he could see the boy well enough, approaching him with a gun in his hand. The boy was smiling, and Kempka opened his mouth to scream, but a croak came out. Roland knelt in front of him. The boy's face was covered with sweat, and a pulse beat at his temple. He cocked the .38 and held the barrel about 3 inches from Kempka's skull.
"Please," Kempka begged. "Please, Roland. Don't."
Roland's smile was rigid, his eyes huge behind the goggles. He said, "Sir, Roland, and don't you forget it." Laurie heard a shot. Then, about 10 seconds later, there was a second shot. He gripped the boy's automatic in his right hand and threw his shoulder against the door. It still wouldn't give. He kicked at it again, but the damn thing was stubborn. He was about to start shooting through the door when he heard the bolts being thrown back. The door opened. The boy was standing there, a .38 dangling in his hand, gore splattered across his face and in his hair. He was grinning, and he said in a fast, excited, drugged voice, "It's over, I did it, I did it, I showed him how a king's knight gets even, I did it." Laurie lifted the automatic to blow the boy away, but the twin barrels of a shotgun probed the back of his neck. Sheila Fontana said. She'd heard the commotion and had come over to see what was happening, and other people were coming through the dark as well, carrying lanterns and flashlights. "Drop it, or you get dropped." The automatic hit the ground.
"Don't kill me," Laurie whimpered. "Okay? I just worked for Mr. Kempka, that's all. I just did what he said, okay?"
"Want me to kill him?" Sheila asked Roland. The boy just stared and grinned. "He's shit-faced," she thought. "He's either drunk or stoned."
"Listen, I don't care what the kid did to Kempka." Lowry's voice cracked. "He wasn't anything to me. I just drove for him. Just followed his orders. Listen, I can do the same for you if you want. You, the kid, and Colonel Macklin, I can take care of things for you. Keep everybody around here in line. I'll do whatever you say to do. You say jump, I'll ask how high."
"I showed him. I sure did,"
Roland rattled on, beginning to weave on his feet.
"I showed him. Listen, you and the kid and Colonel Macklin are the head honchos around here as far as I can see," Laurie told Sheila. "I mean, if Kempka's dead..."
"Let's go take a look, then."
Sheila poked his neck with a shotgun, and Laurie eased past Roland into the trailer. They found the fat man crumpled in a bloody heap against one wall. There was the smell of burnt skin in the air. Kempka had been shot through the skull and through the heart at close range.
"All the guns and food and everything are yours now," Laurie said. "I just do what I'm told. You just tell me what to do. I'll do it, I swear to God."
"Drag that fat carcass out of our trailer, then."
Startled, Sheila looked toward the door. Macklin stood there, leaning against the door frame, shirtless and dripping. The black overcoat was draped over his shoulders, the stump of his right arm hidden in its folds. His face was pale, his eyes sunken in violet hollows. Roland stood beside him, weaving and swaying, about to collapse.
"I don't know what the hell happened here," Macklin said, speaking with an effort. "But if everything belongs to us now, we're moving into the trailer. Get that thing out of here."
Laurie looked stricken.
"By myself? I mean, he's going to be damned heavy."
"Either drag him or join him."
Laurie went to work.
"And clean up this mess when you get through," Macklin told him, going over to the rack of rifles and handguns. God, what an arsenal, he thought. He had no idea what had transpired here, but Kempka was dead, and somehow they were in control. The trailer was theirs. The food, the water, the arsenal, the whole encampment was theirs. He was stunned, still exhausted by the pain he'd endured. But he felt somehow stronger, too, somehow cleaner. He felt like a man again instead of a sniveling, scared dog
Colonel James B. Macklin had been reborn. Laurie had almost manhandled the corpse to the door.
"I can't make it," he protested, trying to catch his breath. "He's too heavy."
Macklin whirled around and walked toward Laurie, stopping only when their faces were about 4 inches apart. Macklin's eyes were bloodshot, and they bored into the other man's with furious intensity.
"You listen to me, Slime,"
Macklin said menacingly. Laurie listened. "I'm in charge here now. Me. What I say goes without question. I'm going to teach you about discipline and control, mister. I'm going to teach everybody about discipline and control. There will be no questions, no hesitations when I give an order, or there will be executions, public executions. You care to be the first?"
No,
Laurie said in a small, scared voice. "No what?"
"No, sir,"
was the reply. "Good. Now you spread the word around, Laurie. I'm going to get these people organized and off their asses. If they don't like my way of doing things, they can get out."
"Organized? Organized for what?"
"You think there won't come a time when we'll have to fight to keep what we've got? Mister, there are going to be plenty of times we'll have to fight, if not to keep what we have, then to take what we want."
"We're not any fucking army,"
Laurie said. "You will be," Macklin promised. And he motioned toward the arsenal. "You're going to learn to be, mister, and so is everybody else. Now get that piece of shit out of here, corporal."
"Huh?
Corporal Laurie? That's your new rank, and you'll be living in the tent out there. This trailer is for headquarters staff."
Oh, Christ, Laurie thought. This guy's gone wacko.
But he kind of liked the idea of being a corporal. That sounded important. He turned away from the colonel and started hauling Kempka's body again. A funny thought hit him, and he almost giggled, but he held it back. "The king is dead," he thought. "Long live the king!" He hauled the corpse down the steps and the trailer door shut. He saw several men standing around, attracted by all the ruckus, and he began barking orders at them to pick up Freddy Kempka's corpse and carry it out to the edge of the dirtwort land. They obeyed him like automatons, and Judd Laurie figured he might grow to enjoy playing soldiers.
Part 7. Thinking About Tomorrow. Heads will roll. The straitjacket game. Suicide mission. My people. A smoky old glass. Christian in a Cadillac. Green froth. Chapter 41.
"My name is Alvin Mangren. I'm Lord Alvin now. Welcome to my kingdom."
The young blonde madman, sitting on his toilet throne, motioned with a slender hand.
"Do you like it?"
Josh was sickened by the smell of death and decay. He, Swan, and Leona were sitting together on the floor of the Kmart's pet department at the rear of the store. In the small cages around them were dozens of dead canaries and parakeets, and dead fish lay moldering in their tanks. Beyond a glassed-in display area, a few kittens and puppies were drawing flies. He longed to bash that grinning blonde-bearded face, but his wrists and ankles were chained and padlocked. Both Swan and Leona were bound by ropes. Around them stood the bald-headed Neanderthal, the man with bulging fish eyes, and about 6 or 7 others. The black-bearded man and the dwarf in the shopping cart lurked nearby, the dwarf clutching Swan's dousing rod in his stubby fingers.
"I fixed the juice," Lord Alvin offered, reclining on his throne and eating grapes. "That's why the lights are on."
His murky green eyes shifted from Josh to Swan and back again. Leona was still bleeding from the gash in her head, and her eyes fluttered as she fought off shock.
"I hooked a couple of portable generators up to the electrical system. I've always been good with electricity, and I'm a very good carpenter, too. Jesus was a carpenter, you know."
He spat out seeds.
"Do you believe in Jesus?"
Yes,
Josh managed to croak. I do, too. I had a dog named Jesus once. I crucified him, but he didn't come back to life. Before he died, he told me what to do to the people in the brick house. Off went their heads.
Josh sat very still, looking up into those green bottomless eyes. Lord Alvin smiled, and for a moment he resembled a choir boy, all draped in purple and ready to sing.
I fixed the lights here so we'd attract plenty of fresh meat, like you folks, plenty of play toys. See, everybody's left us at the pathway. All the lights went out and the doctors went home, but we found some of them, like Dr. Baylor. And then I baptized my disciples in the blood of Dr. Baylor and sent them out into the world, and the rest of us stayed here.
He cocked his head to one side, and his smile faded.
It's dark outside, he said. It's always dark, even in the daytime. What's your name, friend?
Josh told him. He could smell his own sacred sweat over the odor of dead animals.
Josh,
Lord Alvin repeated. He ate a grape.
Mighty Joshua blew those old walls of Jericho right fucking down, didn't you?
He smiled again and motioned at a young man with slick back black hair and red paint circling his eyes and mouth. The young man came forward holding a jar of something. Swan heard some of the men giggle with excitement. Her heart was still pounding, but the tears were gone now, and so was the molasses that had been jamming up her brain gears. She knew these crazy men had escaped from the pathway place, and she knew that death was before her, sitting on a toilet. She wondered what had happened to Mule, and since she'd bumped into the mannequins, she shoved that memory quickly aside. There'd been no sight or sound of the terrier. The young man with red paint on his face knelt in front of Josh, unscrewed the lid of the jar, and revealed white grease paint. He got a dab of the stuff on his forefinger and reached toward Josh's face. Josh jerked his head back, but the Neanderthal gripped Josh's skull and held it steady as the grease paint was applied.
"You're going to look pretty, Josh," Lord Alvin told him. "You're going to enjoy this."
Through the waves of pain in her legs and the numbing frost of shock, Leona watched the grease paint going on. She realized the young man was painting Josh's face to resemble a skull.
"I know a game," Lord Alvin said. "A game called Straight Jacket. I made it up. Know why? Dr. Baylor said, 'Come on, Alvin, come get your pill like a good boy.' And I had to walk down that long, stinking corridor every day."
He held up two fingers.
"Twice a day. I'm a very good carpenter, though."
He paused, blinking slowly, as if trying to get his thoughts back in whack.
"I used to build dog houses, not just ordinary dog houses. I built mansions and castles for dogs. I built a replica of the Tower of London for Jesus. That's where they chopped the heads of witches off."
The corner of his left eye began ticking. He was silent, staring into space, as the finishing touches were put to the grease paint skull that covered Josh's face. When the job was done, the Neanderthal released Josh's head. Lord Alvin finished his grapes and licked his fingers.
"In the straitjacket game," he said between licks, "you get taken to the front of the store. The lady and the kid stay here. Now, you get a choice. What do you want freed, your arms or your legs?"
"What's the point of this shit?"
Lord Alvin waggled an admonishing finger.
"Arms or legs, Josh?"
"I need my legs free," Josh reasoned. "Then, no, I can always hop or hobble. I've got to have my arms free. No, my legs." It was impossible to decide without knowing what was going to happen. He hesitated, trying to think clearly. He felt Swan watching him. He looked at her, but she shook her head, could offer no help.
"My legs," Josh finally said.
"Good, that didn't hurt, did it?"
Again, there was a giggle and rustle of excitement from the onlookers.
"Okay, you get taken to the front, and your legs are freed. Then you get 5 minutes to make it all the way through the store back here."
He pulled up the right sleeve of his purple robe. On his arm were 6 wristwatches.
"See, I can keep the time to the exact second. 5 minutes from when I say go, and not 1 second more, Josh."
Josh released a sigh of relief. Thank God. He'd chosen his legs to be freed.
He could see himself crawling and hobbling through the Kmart in this ridiculous farce.
"Oh, yes," Lord Alvin continued. "My subjects are going to try their best to kill you between the front of the store and here."
He smiled cheerfully.
"They'll be using knives, hammers, axes, everything except guns. See, guns wouldn't be fair. Now, don't worry too much. You can use the same things if you find them, and if you can get your hands on them, or you can use anything else to protect yourself with. But you won't find any guns out there, not even a pellet rifle. Isn't that a fun game?"
Josh's mouth tasted like sawdust. He was afraid to ask, but had to.
"What if I don't get back here in 5 minutes?"
The dwarf jumped up and down in the shopping cart and pointed the dowsing rod at him like a jester's scepter.
"Death! Death! Death!" he yelled.
"Thank you, imp," Lord Alvin said. "Josh, you've seen my mannequins, haven't you? Aren't they pretty? So lifelike, too. Want to know how we make them?"
He glanced up at someone behind Josh and nodded. Immediately there was a guttural growl that ascended into a high-pitched whining. Josh smelled gasoline. He already knew what the sound was, and his gut clenched. He looked over his shoulder and saw the Neanderthal standing there holding a whirring chainsaw that was streaked and clumped with dried gore.
"If you don't beat the clock, friend Josh," Lord Alvin said, leaning forward, "the lady and the child will join my mannequin collection. Their heads will, I mean."
He lifted a finger, and the chainsaw rattled to a halt.
"Heads will roll!" Imp jumped and grinned. "Heads will roll!"
"Of course," the madman in the purple robe added. "If they kill you out there, it won't matter very much, will it? We'd have to find a big body to go along with your head, wouldn't we? Well, are we ready?"
"Ready!"
Imp shouted.
"Ready!"
the black-bearded brute said.
"Ready!"
the others hollered, dancing and capering.
"Ready!"
Lord Alvin reached over and took the dowsing rod from Imp. He tossed it to the floor about 3 feet away.
"Cross that line, friend Josh, and you shall know wonders."
He'll kill us anyway, Josh knew, but he had no choice. His eyes met Swan's. She stared at him calmly and resolutely, and she tried to send the thought, "I believe in you," to him. He gritted his teeth. "Protect the child. Yeah, I've done a damn fine job, haven't I?" The black-bearded man and another of the lunatics hauled Josh to his feet.
"Kick ass," Leona whispered. The pain in her skull was all but blinding her.
Josh was half-carried, half-dragged out of the pet department, through the housewares, the sporting goods, and then out along the center aisle to the row of cash registers at the front. A third man was waiting, armed with a double-barreled shotgun and a ring of keys dangling from his belt. Josh was thrown to the floor, the breath whistling between his teeth.
"Legs," he heard the bearded man say, and the one with the keys bent down to unsnap the padlocks.
Josh was aware of a steady, roaring noise, and he looked at the windows. A torrential rain was falling, some of it sweeping in through the broken glass. There was no sign of the horse, and Josh hoped it would find a dry place to die in.
"God help us all," he thought.
Though he hadn't seen any of the other maniacs when he was being brought to the front, he knew they were out there in the store, hiding, waiting, getting ready for the game to begin. "Protect the child." The rasping voice that had come from Papa's throat was fresh in his mind. "Protect the child." He had to get across that line in 5 minutes, no matter what the crazy shitters threw at him. He would have to use all the moves he remembered from his football days, have to make those rusty knees young again. "Oh, Lord," he prayed, "if you ever smiled on a dumb fool, show those pearly whites right now." The last padlock was unsnapped, and the chains were removed from Josh's legs.
He was pulled to his feet, his wrists still shackled tightly together. The chain curled around his forearms and hands as well. He could open and close his left hand, but the right was balled shut and immobile. He looked toward the rear of the Kmart, and his heart lurched. The damn place seemed as long as 10 football fields. In the pet department, Swan had laid her head on Leona's shoulder. The woman was breathing erratically, fighting to keep her eyes open. Swan knew Josh was going to do all he could to reach them, but she knew also that he might fail. Lord Alvin was smiling